Well, I think the other two have actually said everything I was going to say, but I've written it out very carefully anyway, so I will say it to you. Why do I adore MacNeice coming from the south of Ireland, as far south as you can get on the coast, and coming from a culture that must have seemed completely alien to anybody from MacNeice's background. First of all, I admire his reticence. As Mike Longley says, Ireland had inoculated him from political certainties. And I think that's very important. Reticence, I think, is a highly educated stance in a poet. It takes learning and a certain amount of artistic good breeding. I like him because he wasn't afraid of the ambiguities of the Irish situation. He also knew that politics alone couldn't save the individual from himself or herself. I mean, no political document can affect memory or nightmares from childhood. These are addressed head-on in MacNeice's poetry. Because he had a distinct sensibility, yet he knew sensibility wasn't enough. This sensibility is more than a Protestant thing. It's an angle or a tilt towards belief and patria. One finds it in Elizabeth Bowen, at least I do, in the character of Lois in The Last September, for example. It's also in the travel writing of a Cork writer, another Cork writer, Robert Gibbings, his descriptions of Tonga or the Wye Valley and his understanding of the work that goes into cutting stone. MacNeice had that, I think. He was just too illuminated to allow chauvinism or nationalism to take hold of processes that were much deeper than anything political. I admire him for that, having been steeped in politics from childhood myself. I admire him and adore him for his times. Now, we can't really praise a poet for his times, but we can actually praise his responses. The 30s were a frantic and frenzied era. In fact, most of the evil of the 30s had its origins in the 20s, but we could spend an afternoon on that. But the evil of the era was astonishing, and very early on, MacNeice, because of his, I think, world view, which is quite different from the Irish world view in the 1930s, he was already engaged with that fight emotionally. In fact, he was so engaged with the fight against fascism, I think, in Europe, and the evil that was Hitler, that it's difficult to see how he could have maintained any kind of imaginative intensity in the bleakness of the 40s or the 50s. You could say, looking at him, that he was actually the first of the less deceived in this world. It wasn't so much Larkin as the critical conditions that granted a poetic license to Larkin to be the poet he was, and a lot of that license had been worked on already by MacNeice. It's no accident, really, and I'm speaking as a librarian, it's no accident that Larkin was a professional librarian in Belfast and, in fact, was celebrated as a poet while he was in Belfast as a librarian. I love MacNeice because he's not Daniel Corkery. He's not who I am. He didn't presume to speak for Ulster, and he certainly had no intention of speaking for the crowd who assembled at the Munster hurling final in Turles County, Tipperary, in the introduction to Daniel Corkery's Sing in Anglo-Irish Literature. Politically and culturally, the Second World War gave era to itself, and it heightened Ulster's moral sense of itself. It's interesting to look at the publications and the documents and the frenzy of publishing in the immediate aftermath of the victory of De Valera in 1932 and the Eucharistic Congress, which was equal in influence, if you like, culturally in the South, which was 1932. I think the events are linked in the minds of the Irish in the South. They completed a vision of Ireland that arose, I think, during the repeal movement of O'Connell in the 1830s. And by 1939, 100 years later, Ireland was complete, but Ulster was elsewhere. Louis MacNeice knew that, and he lived with it. So did Elizabeth Bowen, I think. Because, also, I adore his work because he discovered that poets don't actually live in a country. They live in a bohemian air pocket which was a lovely expression that Peter MacDonald used in a poem I read in the TLS this year, A Bohemian Air Pocket. He was discussing the Lyric Theatre in Belfast. That bohemian air pocket is kind of where we survive from writing to typing to sending away to publishing to assessing the response. He knew also that the poem could be a long form like the novel, but it wasn't a novel. Autumn Journal, for me, is one of the great masterpieces. It actually has never been equaled. It's actually not even in Yeats. 1919 of Yeats is probably more ambitious, maybe, but to me, Autumn Journal was already vulnerable to aerial bombing, if you like. It really is like the Anabasis of Saint-Jean-Paris, or the, I don't know how to pronounce it correctly, Axion Esti of Elitis. He knew that a poem could become a feature-length drama, a prodigious search of appearances, as Wallace Stevens tells us. He also survived us and our intellectual atmosphere. Now, I could go on forever about this. It's something that has always interested me because I had to survive it myself. In the 30s, just yesterday in the library in Cork City, I was going through the old stores. Thousands and thousands of books and journals on the Gaelic world and on Irish history. More than 1,000 printed alone in 1938. A kind of post-facto establishment of who we were now that we were making ourselves whole as 26 county Republicans. And there was an enormous coherence in Irish life and a frenzy. Remember that the main battle in Irish life in the 1930s was not against fascism, it was against jazz dancing. It animated more editorials and sermons. Fan O'Brien has estimated, going on the granting of licenses in 1937, 38, 39, that there was on average, there were 10,000 jazz dances in Ireland every year in those years. So it wasn't really the mass movement of fascists and their salutes. It was actually quite good foxtrots that terrified the Gaelic people. And the consequences of that, which, you know, actually, wherever a boy and a girl met in a short story by William Trevor, there was the end of one kind of whole Ireland. So I love Louis MacNeice for his reticence, his authority as a poet, his belief in the kind of hermetic air pocket that poets exist in, which in fact is a kind of layer either beneath or above a country. I think his shyness is also a very interesting thing, which I think is a kind of austere reticence, which is sometimes hidden, I think. Here for December the 11th, 1950, here is George Seferi's Greek poet, his diary. I met Louis MacNeice. This was in Ankara. He read poems from Yeats down to his own generation in a small packed room at the university, except for a few men, all young girls. I was impressed with the way his recitation changed when, at the end, he read three of his own poems. Another tone, warmer, at times carried away with himself. I wouldn't say, as one might think, that he didn't care for the other poets. I suspect that, since he's such a shy man, he had to gather more momentum to present his own self. I thought how brilliantly perceptive that is about MacNeice. But there's just no time to go into other matters, but I had Sarah Connolly's copy of Horizon here, which is dedicated to the Republic, really, but it has poems by MacNeice in it. The Kenyon Review for Summer 1941 was a very interesting article by Martin van Duhur about the Nazi purge of philosophy in Germany. This was summer 41, then the next issue, winter 41, poems by Louis MacNeice. Are viewed as history, they remind us of what we always would rather forget, that what we are or prefer is conditioned by circumstances, that evil and good are relative to ourselves, who are creatures of period. Thanks very much.